Today's episode of This Week I Learned is brought to you by the 400 horsepower Lincoln MKZ with a Revel audio sound system that gives you audiophile quality sound no matter where you sit in the vehicle. Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week, I learned that plants can smell. Plants are stuck in the ground, that is. They can't run, jump, or hide. They are very vulnerable to any passing predator, which is why they have built up an incredible and intricate array of defenses to ward off hungry critters. You can think of plants like live tripwires. A bug passes into its realm of sensitivity and certain alarms go off and defenses go up. Previous studies have found that plants can feel the footsteps of a tiny insect on its leaf. They can also hear bugs nibbling away at their blades. Now, a new study published in the journal Nature Communications found that plants also have a sense of smell. Now, of course, plants don't have the organ systems for such senses like touch, hearing, and smell that we do, but even without noses or brains, plants are able to sense, identify, and react to the odor of their predators. A 2013 study found that flowers that had been exposed to the stink of its insect predator were later passed over by the actual bug when it came flying by to lay its eggs. And this tipped scientists off to an odor-oriented defense. Now, in a follow-up study, researchers get to the bottom of this stinky science. First, they analyze the stink of the predator, in this case, the goldenrod gall fly. They found that the gas mixture that emanates from the bug is comprised of 20 different fly odors. But really, there are three main chemicals that made up about 95% of that smell. So now that scientists had identified the main chemicals that made up the odor, they prepared their flowers. In this case, the Canada goldenrod. The team exposed one group of plants to the insect's complete perfume, so that 20-ingredient gas mixture. Then they exposed other plants to synthetic versions of those three target chemicals. Finally, scientists released the hounds, or in this case, the bugs. And they found that the plants that had been exposed to the entire gas mixture had less leaf damage after their encounter with the flies. And when it came to the synthetic chemical tests, only one chemical produced a similar protected result with the plants. And this led researchers to believe that there was really only one chemical creating the smell that plants use to sniff out predatory flies. You see, plants are able to pick up on teeny tiny amounts of odor, in this case, a singular chemical, produced by flies, and this rallies their defense mechanisms and keeps the bugs at bay. And they do this when an attack is imminent. This not only helps the plant save energy, but also helps them fine-tune the defense to the specifics of their attacker. So, in the case of the goldenrod flower and the goldenrod fly, the plant's defense was the release of a hormone called harmonic acid. With the bug stench in the air, harmonic acid accumulated on the leaves of the plants, and this acid neutralizes the bug's digestive enzymes in the saliva. This means the flies can no longer break down the leaf tissue as easily, which leaves leaves more intact. This week I learned that bacteria can feel. Yep, those single-celled microorganisms that can be both good and bad for us, causing a range of illnesses, have a sense of touch. It was previously understood that bacteria communicate with their environment through chemical signals. But a new study from the University of Basel reveals that bacteria also have a mechanism that allows them to recognize surfaces and change their behavior rapidly. You see, when bacteria adhere to the surfaces of a host, they typically colonize the tissue and attack. This leads to the formation of communities of bacteria that can together fight to resist antibiotics and other disease-fighting initiatives. But different surfaces require different adaptations for the successful spread of infection. Enter flagellum. Flagellum is an appendage that some bacteria have. Some bacteria have just one flagellum, some have several, others have a different version, others shed it eventually. It varies. The flagellum is a whip-like structure that propels the bacteria around and allows the bacteria to make contact with the surface and feel. Bacteria obviously don't have a central nervous system, nor muscle for that matter. They're able to move thanks to the energy generated by the transfer of protons down its cell membrane. When the flagellum comes into contact with a surface, the proton motor that drives the appendage is interrupted. Without the flow of protons, the bacteria is briefly able to sense the type of surface it has reached and can adhere to and anchor itself in the proper way. So, in a sense, bacteria use touch to understand their world of membranes and intestines, just the way we use touch to understand our world. This week I learned that in a solar system far, far away lives a planet where it snows sunscreen. The planet is called Kepler 13ab and it lives some 1,700 light years from Earth. It's what astronomers refer to as a hot Jupiter. Hot Jupiters are planets from other solar systems that are massive, like our Jupiter. But whereas our Jupiter is freezing, like minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit on a good day, hot Jupiters are, you guessed it, scorching. That's because they orbit very close to their parent star, like even closer than Mercury orbits our Sun. Mercury spins around the Sun in 88 Earth days, but some hot Jupiters orbit so quickly that their year is actually shorter than just one Earth day. Kepler 13ab is no different. First of all, it is in fact massive, more than six times the size of our Jupiter. It's also so close to its parent star that it circles in less than two Earth days. Because of this, the Kepler 13ab is one of the hottest known worlds. Dayside temperatures can reach nearly 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Dayside, by the way, is a reference to the fact that this planet, like so many close orbiters, is fixated in the same spot and doesn't rotate. So there's a day side of the planet and a night side of the planet. But the Kepler 13ab has an interesting quirk that the Hubble observations recently noticed. The temperatures in the higher reaches of the planet's atmosphere are cooler than those below, whereas the top atmospheres of most hot Jupiters still radiate heat. It seems that the Kepler 13ab has a unique gravitational makeup, and this creates a cold trap in the atmosphere. And here is where the sunscreen bit comes in. So the thing about hot Jupiters is that their atmospheres contain titanium oxide, which is a metallic chemical compound that also happens to be the active ingredient in sunscreen. Titanium oxide is exceptionally absorbent to radiation, which is why, as I mentioned, it usually radiates heat as you get higher and higher in the atmosphere. But on Kepler 13ab, strong winds actually whip the titanium oxide over to the night side of the planet. There, the hot chemical gas cools and condenses into clouds. These clouds then drop the sunscreen snow into the lower atmosphere. But instead of dropping to the ground, as you'd expect snow to do, it stays stuck in the lower atmosphere because of the planet's powerful gravity. And this weird combination of the chilled chemical that makes sunscreen and gravity is what creates the planet's unique cold trap, which is an incredibly rare find to behold on these mysterious exoplanets. This week I learn what those silly little arms on the Tyrannosaurus Rex were probably for. Frankly, the comically short arms have baffled researchers. Many came to the conclusion that the arms were, at best, used to help the dinosaur push itself up from the ground when it fell, or perhaps they helped with mating in some way, but otherwise the T-Rex arm seemed completely functionless. The thing is, the T-Rex hasn't always had such scrawny arms. Early ancestors of the predator had longer arms that they actually used for grasping. But as time went on, the T-Rex began to use its massive head and giant jaws to seize prey and foe alike. As their arms got less and less use, the limbs eventually atrophied. But recent studies have revealed some rather robust bones in those measly little limbs. And curiously, the arms also end in two really sharp claws. The fact that the claws are two-pronged instead of three or four is interesting here, because two claws give more slashing power than three or four would, because each one can apply heavier pressure. Those claws are also quite sharp, more like a bear than an eagle, which has flatter ones that they use to grasp. All of this information led scientists to think that maybe, just maybe, those tiny arms were used for vicious slashing at close range. But a lot of scientists were skeptical about this hypothesis, because on adult rexes, those short but sharp arms barely reach past its chest. So there's just no way it would have used its arm as its primary weapon in a fight. But an epiphany came in looking at the younger dinos. A T-Rex's arms grow more slowly than its body, so the younger predators would have had proportionally longer arms than their elders. So it's possible those arms, being not so squat and not yet so little, came in quite handy during those encounters with prey for those youngins, when a whip of the arm could slash and subdue a tasty meal before the massive head came chopping down for a bite. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can check out theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any scientific tidbits, fascinating studies, or historical revelations that you'd like to share, email me. You can reach me at podcasts@theweek.com. And until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.